by chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you say it coming, no time to play out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make the heaven the middle of it. Grass make the heaven the middle. We are grass make the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler along with my co-host,
Charlotte Littlefield. Good evening, George.
Okay, Charlotte, how you doing up there? Okay, everything great?
Yeah, everything's fine. We're having a nice December.
Oh, boy, I tell you what, did the winter come a little early this year or what?
No, I don't think so. We have no snow yet, so. But cold weather's here. We can tell winter's here. But, yeah, we haven't had a particularly early winter.
Okay. I want our listening audience to learn a little bit more about you, Charlotte. I know we've broached this before on our program. But this first hour tonight, it's going to just be me and you talking back and forth, and we've got several issues and events that to discuss. But tell our listening audience a little bit about your background, where you were from originally in the Navy and the Army and things like that.
Well, sure, the Chinese know. I suppose everybody should know.
Right. Oh, that's right.
It's an inside joke. I was born in Northern California in the late 60s, and I was raised in the Santa Clara Valley in a city called San Jose near San Francisco and Oakland. I was very influenced by the return of the Vietnam veterans. My neighborhood was mostly, in my mind anyway, it was very multicultural, very interesting. I grew up in a time in California that was very, how would you describe that? Towards volatile?
We
had the gangs coming out, and we had a lot of drugs coming in from South America. It was just a really crazy time. There was a population boom. Long story short, from Northern California, joined the military out of the state of Texas, relocated to the state of Texas in my late teens, and joined the military, the Navy, out of Texas. I served 5 years active duty and then 1 year in the reserve and 2 years in the IRR. And then I had a break in service and I married the sweetheart that I met in Scotland, and we had started a family. And let's see, I had a family for about 10 years. I returned to military service in just before 9/11, George.
That's right. You went back in the Army, didn't you, this time?
I sure did. Well, yeah, I was kind of landlocked.
I'll never forget the day you graduated from your OCS class at Camp Mabry here in Austin. You were number one in your class academically. You know? That made me
proud. Yeah, I remember. It was quite the honor.
That made me real proud, Charlotte.
And I got a story that goes with that. You know, I have a lieutenant colonel, and I wrote his name down. I can't remember his name off the top of my head, but I did write it down. I ran across it the other day, George. He was an instructor that had from Louisiana, who had a very big impact on me. He would, we'd come in, you know, they treated us real rough in the field, and we came in and were given a good meal and sat in a classroom, and everybody just wanted to sleep because we were so drug out and tired.
Right.
But this instructor, the lieutenant colonel, had a big stick. And every time somebody in the class would doze off, he would take that stick and slap it as hard as he could against the desk. And everybody had to stand up and shout, train or die.
Oh, yeah, that's a good story. Train or die. Man, one dead trainer is what I'd
hard
yell.
For me. Yeah, that lieutenant colonel with the club, he had my attention, I'll tell you what. And that's when the studying started. And I contribute a lot of my academic success to the good instructors that I had, and I had some really good training.
Well, you know, that's a beautiful experience you had there. First, now, you showed me recently, we spent a little time over Thanksgiving, and you showed me some photographs of you climbing the mast of a ship and, what, adjusting the radar antennas and stuff. Tell us about that.
Well, sure. One of my big adventures in a port in Italy, this was during my Navy time, this would have been back in the 80s, my first ship, I was stationed on two different ships. Believe it or not, George, I got 4 years of sea duty.
My gosh, but that's a long time.
I know,
man.
But
yeah.
I know, right? But it's because my ship was sitting in a forward deployed position that had to keep it in international water. So basically, the ship just wasn't anchored to the pier. In fact, I don't believe it was anchored at all. I think it must have been. It was anchored to a dry dock. And that's by virtue of living on that particular ship. And for whatever reason, the people that served on board the site in Holy Loch, Scotland, the USS Simon Lake and the Dunley before that, I believe it was, or the Hunley before that. Yeah, they all get special sea duty pay. So I got it too. So I got the special sea duty, you know, that says I got 4 years at sea, but I really don't. I just have 4 years of ship living.
Right.
You know,
we were up in Philadelphia one time in 2007, and we were driving by the harbor there, and you pointed out a ship that like the one you were on, maybe, but it wasn't the same one, right?
Right. Well, let me get back to the mast in Italy. What took me to Italy? So my first ship, so I was on the Shenandoah. Sorry about that. I was on the Shenandoah, and we were in port in Italy, and we needed to change the top navigational light, but to get up past all that, I had to other sailors and engineers, you know, we called ourselves engineers. You were either a fireman, what were those designations again? This is so there's like fireman, and then there was
bosun's mate.
Oh, seaman. Seaman. Yeah, bosun's mate. Yeah, seaman. Yeah, remember the divisions that they broke people down into. So anyway, I'm just going to say engineers went up there, or technicians went up before me to ground all the different equipment to make sure that it was safe for me to go up there in the first place.
Right.
So I wasn't the first one up there. But, yeah, my way up, I accidentally touched one of the dishes, and it fried me for just a minute. And I howled out to – and they're like, I thought I, you know, basically it just hadn't gotten perfectly grounded, I guess, and I was pretty lucky.
Well, you're lucky. You
got past that.
You
got up
electrocuted.
There. Well, I don't know if it was a microwave dish or what kind of communication dish or what it was that I grounded against, but it was quite a shock. Yeah. So I climbed up there, changed that navigational light, and I climbed back down. Yeah, they used to send me into all the small and hard to reach places because I was pretty agile.
Right. Now, didn't you support nuclear submarines, what, over in Scotland for a while? Is that what you did?
Yeah, I was a radiological worker for the United States Navy as a sailor. I worked on at a forward deployed nuclear refit facility during the Cold War. That was my experiences, you know, as a young adult. I had 5 years of active duty by the time I was 22 years old because I had joined the military when I was 17.
Okay.
And so what the time frame I'm talking to you about is like when I was 19 or 20, you know, 22,
right.
I was over in Scotland, you know, working on that. So it was quite a while ago. I'm pushing 50 now. So it's been quite a while. And of course the site's decommissioned. But yes, I was a radiological worker. I worked on nuclear submarines. I also worked on destroyer tender. That was my first ship, the USS Shenandoah. We tended to destroyers, and then obviously a submarine tender is going to tender to submarine. So it was the boomer class, and I don't think it's any top secret or anything like that. There's an alumni site. I mean, people know about that location.
Yeah. By now and everything, it's been a few years since you did that. Then later on, you had a family. Then you went back into the military and the army, and graduated tops in your class at OCS there at Camp Mabry. And then in the Army, what were your duties there?
Well, I went from Navy enlisted, and if I remember correctly, going into the National Guard up in Iowa, my Navy training actually equated to five different Army MOSs. So they had to narrow it down, and they put me in a category called mechanical engineering or something like this, where a mechanic, so basically you're a technical mechanic, for that can do electrical work. That can do electrical work is basically what the designation was, without going into any details. And I'm sure maybe the designations have changed by this year, George. But at any rate, I started out working, wanted to get into the Texas Technician Program, which would be a warrant officer program. But I was accepted into officer candidate school in the state of Texas. So I transferred from Iowa to the state of Texas during the beginning of my OCS training. So I arrived to the state of Texas as an OCS candidate. I had no prior, I didn't come to the National Guard through the enlisted ranks for the Army.
Right, sure. Then you went through after graduating from the OCS, where were you deployed at? Where were you stationed?
I was active Guard Reserve, which is definitely a state status. However, I was under the impression that my time spent was in U.S. Army South, which is out of, San Antonio. I was, some people get deployed to CENTCOM, some people get deployed to other areas of operation, and theoretically, or the way I understood my orders, was that I was deployed to the AOR of the Central and South America, but basically all my work kept me in San Antonio.
Right, right. So how long were you there in San Antonio?
Oh, about 2.5-3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I made the rank of, my highest rank in the military service was first lieutenant.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you're pretty well retired now, right?
Yeah, I'm out of the game since 2006. Of course, George, you and I went on the radio for Hot and Heavy after I got out of the military.
Right. That's when you took this name, Littlefield, didn't you? Charlotte Littlefield?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, about the time we started broadcasting, and our first guest was Vicki Karp. Remember her?
Of course.
Yeah,
yes.
I saw her a couple of months ago.
Facebook.
Yeah.
Oh, good. In person. Good. I see her on Facebook occasionally.
And Voter Rescue, she's still doing that. And, they're just continuing to work, steady at this voter, fraud and stuff like that, trying to get things going. Well, what was interesting during our visit, and what happened was I went up to Dallas to do a JFK conspiracy conference there. That was promoted and produced by Trine Day Books and Judith Berry Baker and Caravan to Midnight, John B. Wells, and a few other sponsors. And spent 3 days there in Dallas, 20th, 21st, 22nd. Did about 25 to 30 hours of video. And then I flew up there and you picked me up and we spent about 4 days together where you're living now. But when we were up there, what was interesting was that there were a couple of young people with us, and I remember it was the day before Thanksgiving, and they were playing on, on YouTube, wasn't it? The History of Human Rights, right? Okay? And it was very interesting. I have a small clip here that I'm going to play for a couple of minutes here for our listening audience to sort of get a gist of this. And then I'll stop it, and then we'll discuss it, okay? So listen to this for a few minutes.
Human rights is, that's a good question.
Human rights. That's
tough.
Wow.
I
don't even know how to give that a definition.
I would probably have to do a little bit of homework or something.
Yeah, any right that I think any, just as a normal, human, any...
The rights that humans have.
This is a very large debate.
Non saprei, una domanda complicatissima.
We just take them for granted that they're there, but we don't even consider what they are.
Human rights are the rights you have simply because you're human. It's how you instinctively expect and deserve to be treated as a person, like the right to live freely, to speak your mind, and to be treated as an equal. There are many kinds of rights. Most apply to a certain group. But human rights are the only ones that apply to absolutely everyone, everywhere. That means kids, old people, poor people, basketball players, garbage men, rappers, teachers, Africans, Indians, Albanians, Christians, Muslims, Kabbalists, atheists, your mom, your dad, an extra neighbor, and you all have the exact same human rights. That's the words. They're universal. But the question remains, what are they?
Name the human rights?
What the human rights are?
The right to live.
Equality between all peoples.
Right to live, religion, the right to...
Is there supposed to be a list somewhere I should be aware of?
According to the United Nations, there are a total of 30 human rights, which are usually lumped together and called simply human rights. They're all listed out in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which is the world's most widely accepted document on the subject. But it was a long time in coming. At first, there were no human rights. If you were in with the right crowd, you were safe. If you weren't, well, you weren't. But then a guy named Cyrus Grace decided to change all that. After conquering Babylon, he did something completely revolutionary. He announced that all slaves were free to go. He also said people had the freedom to choose their religion, no matter what crowd they were a part of. He documented his words on a clay tablet known as the Cyrus Cylinder. And just like that, human rights were born. The idea spread quickly to Greece, to India, and eventually to Rome. They noticed that people naturally followed certain laws, even if they weren't told to. They called this natural law, but it kept getting trampled on by those in power. Not until 1,000 years later in England did they finally get a king to agree that no one can overrule the rights of the people, not even a king. People's rights were finally recognized, and they were now safe from those in power. Kind of. It still took a bunch of British rebels declaring their independence before the king got the point that all men are created equal. Which isn't to say he liked the idea, but he couldn't stop them, and America was born. The French immediately followed with their own revolution for their own rights. Their list was even longer, and they insisted that these rights weren't just made up. They were natural. The Roman concept of natural law had become natural rights. Unfortunately, not everyone was so thrilled. In France, a general named Napoleon decided to overthrow the new French democracy and crown himself emperor of the world. He almost succeeded. But the countries of Europe joined forces and defeated him. Human rights was again a hot topic. They drew up international agreements, broadly granting many rights across Europe. But only across Europe. The rest of the world somehow still didn't qualify. Instead, they got invaded, conquered, and consumed by Europe's massive empires. But then a young lawyer from India decided enough was enough. His name was Mahatma Gandhi, and in the face of violence, he insisted that all people of Earth had rights, not just in Europe. Eventually, even Europeans started to agree. But it wasn't going to be that easy. Two world wars erupted. Hitler exterminated half the Jewish population of Earth in horrifying Nazi death camps. And all told, 90 million people died. Never had human rights been so terrifyingly close to extinction. And never had the world been more desperate for change. So the countries of Earth banded together and formed the United Nations. Their basic purpose was to reaffirm faith in fundamental human rights and the dignity and worth of a human person. But what were human rights? Were they the proclamations of Cyrus? The natural laws of Rome, the declarations of France. Everyone seemed to have a slightly different idea of what human rights should be. But under the supervision of Eleanor Roosevelt, they finally agreed on a set of rights that applied to absolutely everyone. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights. The French concept of natural rights had finally become human rights. So in summary, at first, only a few lucky people had any rights. Until one of those guys decided, hey, other people should have some rights too. Which was great, except not everyone agreed. And it only took a few thousand years of fighting and declarations and more fighting until everyone finally agreed that human rights should apply to everyone. And they all lived happily ever after. Except for one little problem. If people have the right to food and shelter, why are 16,000 children dying of starvation every day? One every 5 seconds. If people have freedom of speech, why are thousands in prison for speaking their minds? If people have the right to education, why are over a billion adults unable to read? If slavery has truly been abolished, why are 27 million people still enslaved today? More than twice as many as in 1800. The fact is, when it was signed, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights did not have the force of law. It was optional. And despite many more documents, conventions, treaties, and laws, it's still little more than words on a page. So the question is, who will make those words a reality?
I have a dream today.
When Dr. King marched over racial equality, he was marching for rights that had been guaranteed by the United Nations for almost 2 decades. But still, he marched. When Nelson Mandela stood up for social justice in the 1990s, his country had already agreed to abolish such discrimination for almost 40 years. But still, he fought. Those who fight today against torture, poverty, and discrimination are not giants or superheroes. They're people. Kids. Mothers. Fathers. Teachers. Free-thinking individuals who refuse to be silent. Who realize that human rights are not a history lesson. They're not words on a page. They're not speeches or commercials or PR campaigns. They are the choices we make every day as human beings. They are the responsibility we all share to respect each other, to help each other, and to protect those in need. As Eleanor Roosevelt said, where, after all, do universal human rights begin? In small places close to home. So close and so small that they cannot be seen on any maps of the world. Yet they are the world of the individual person, the neighborhood he lives in, the school or college he attends, the factory, farm, or office where he works. Such are the places where every man, woman, and child seeks equal justice, equal opportunity, equal dignity without discrimination. Unless these rights have meaning there, they have little meaning anywhere.
Okay, Charlotte, you get that?
No, George, I'm sorry I didn't. However, I am prepared to speak about it because I did watch it previously.
Maybe it didn't come through very well. But anyway, at the beginning, sorry it didn't come through right, but at the beginning, they do a poll, you could say, they ask people what human rights means to them. Okay, and then all of a sudden, they go through asking all these people, and then they give their own individual definition, and then they declare, you know, the hostess of the documentary says, well, the human rights are rights that you have because you're human, and then they explain a little bit about that, and what I see that happens on this, the history of human rights, is that they create a premise, see. At the very beginning, that human rights are rights that you have because you're human, and everybody has all of these. But actually, that would be the rights that I would enumerate or define as natural rights. What are your thoughts, Charlotte?
I agree, and I think it's a slippery slope if we let the ideas and the foundation that is natural law to be overshadowed and replaced with a concept of human law or human rights.
Right.
Because, yeah, a human right, you know, what in, you know, it's, George, it's been my understanding that in the Black's Law Dictionary, or at least this is what I thought I understood, is that definition of a human being was actually a monster in some cases. So
yeah.
Defining what human is very critical. And they can't, it's a very difficult thing, you know, and it's very vague.
Right.
It's very, there's not a lot, as far as I know, there's not been a lot written, you know,
right.
Beyond.
Yeah, but I agree, Charlotte, with what your conclusion was, is that what they've done here is something very clever. They've redefined human rights as natural rights. And so they're telling the viewer on this video that human rights are rights for everyone, but they're actually usurping the idea and concept of natural rights. Now, if you'll remember it, later on in that video, that documentary, The History of Human Rights, they talk about natural rights, don't they?
Briefly, they mention it as
yeah.
a predecessor to human rights.
Exactly.
However, we have to be very careful
yeah.
because the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, and all these things that we hold true, if I'm not mistaken, George, the men that dear, thank you, and hold dear and true, are these were things that came out of the philosophy of natural law, not human rights.
Exactly.
Right, of natural rights or natural law.
Yes.
And so this is a very dangerous precedent because this overshadows our own government's, you know, founding philosophies.
Exactly. And what they do later on, they say that natural rights evolved into human rights and that human rights are a much higher ideal, see, as a result. And who gave us all these human rights? They declared them at the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 1948 in Paris and drew them up, okay? And the UN was, they were promulgated by the UN, see. So what I
and who controls, my question is today then, who controls the UN?
Yes.
Today.
Yeah, well, supposedly, you know.
Who defines the word, you know, human rights? Who, you know, they're pushing
well,
this concept.
The UN has defined it now. See, because they held this conference. And you know what's important is this COP21 that's being held over in Paris today. They're touting this present conference over there as a second important conference followed by that 1948 conference of Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 1948 in Paris. And they're saying that this conference is just as important or more important because of United Nations Conference on Climate Change is basically what they're over doing over there now, which is November 30th to December 11th. It's 12 days long. So what's important about this is that, if you go to the UN and you look at a list of the articles that make up the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, article number 29, and it's number 3 under article 29 says this, and I quote, "These rights and freedoms may in no case be exercised contrary to the purposes and principles of the United Nations." Close quote. So,
and that's the problem, and therein lies the problem.
Exactly. That men, it's just like that old saying, if a government is powerful enough to give you what you want, it's also powerful enough to take back anything they gave you and even extract more from you. See what I mean? So, this human rights thing is a put-up job. And that, I think there's two young people there that were watching this with us, and they said that they were shown this, I think, in middle school, I believe. Is that what you got out of it?
Yes, yeah.
And so the
middle school.
Yeah, middle school is what age? That's pretty impressionable age, isn't it? Huh? 12 to 14 or 12, 13, 14, 15 or something like that these days?
Right.
But anyway, so then, so that's the point we're trying to make here. And then, of course, at the end, they conclude that the UN is the great, you know, promulgator of all these human rights, and they have this great saying there in New York City, and it's just to build a one-world government, and they're going to give us all these great rights, right? As long as we go along with them, we have the rights. If we don't, if we say, hey, I'm not, then you don't have any rights at all.
It's the ultimate, if you're not with us, you're against us.
Yeah, I mean, that's what George W.
It's
Bush
tyranny.
Said.
It's tyranny.
Yes, yes, it is tyranny. And what's important about this is the European Union has the same structure. It's not a democratic type of parliament and all that. They don't even have the committees that are over and above the parliamentarian system in the European Union is who makes the decisions. So it's decisions by panels and groups above the parliament. The parliament there just as a facade to create this Western, like they do in Hollywood. They build a front to a building, and you go in the door, and there's nothing behind there, you know. So this facade that is being built is like that. Now, recently, you had occasion to listen to some of those COP 21 or United Nations Conference on Climate Change, and you pointed out something like what? Ambassadors of change or weather ambassadors? What was it that you pointed out, Shauna?
I think it was climate ambassadors.
Yeah, climate ambassador. That's the word. Yeah, yeah. So there are these new terms that they're beginning to, and also climate justice. I noticed that. Okay. And, well, social justice came out of the left. Okay. The Marxist communist left. See, and this, has a ring about that. They also said, social justice also, in there. They have carbon asset risk. They talked about how to go up on the price of fossil fuels to drive out that, to defeat use of it. Go ahead. Yeah.
Can I be honest? When I heard them actually talking about the carbon tax and how they're going to manage all this,
right.
I mean, it just made my hair curl. I couldn't believe what I was hearing.
Right.
It was surreal to watch part of it.
The conditioning, you must remember that these adults today were children in schools, and those schools were teaching this environmentalism. But it wasn't that to just go out and clean up, the environment, which was necessary because you had Love Canal, you had excesses by chemical companies and petrochemical companies, and they did pollute the environment. This has gone past that to where it's being used now as a political tool to mold people and to manipulate people and to manage people into a one world, new world order. That's basically what is going on now. So that's basically what I see going on in Paris today. And also,
yeah, I agree. That was well said.
Also, where this came out, where this originated, was the Club of Rome, okay? There was a book written called Limits to Growth in about 1972, I believe. And that book established the idea, the concept of sustainability. So in these discussions in Paris today, sustainability runs throughout the whole gamut of what's going on. Now, Maurice Strong is a person in the 70s that started embarking on a mission to create these kinds of ideas, okay? And he just passed away recently, I think just about 5 or 6 days ago, Maurice Strong. He was Canadian. He made millions out of the petrochemical, oil fields in Canada. But then he set up and went along with his Club of Rome, and he was more UN, based than anything, until he got into a scandal on oil for food or food for oil or whatever, during the Iraq exchange over there, and they caught him with a $900,000 check that he cashed they all made money out of these mechanisms. So what we're seeing in Rome today, in Paris today, is a great conclave of individuals that are so well-intentioned and so, compassionate about what they're saying. They get up there on stage on these panel discussions, and they really believe all of this. But the contrarian, who was the guy that we had as the weather interview out of Alabama, Charlotte? Do you remember that name? Is it Simpson? Was it Simpson?
No, I don't. No, I don't, George. I'm sorry.
Anyway, he had a doctorate in meteorology, okay, remember? And what he was saying basically is that weather, much weather, much of the weather is determined by cloud cover, okay? And so he got back on that kind of concept. I think he worked for NASA early on in his career, and they did a lot of cloud cover and reflection studies and all that. And then there were three dynamics in the Pacific. There's El Nino, La Nina, and then there's a decibel. Not, what was that called? There's a Pacific 22-year cycle in there. I've forgotten what it's called. But anyway, they ostracized this guy. He doesn't like it at all. But when you put $4 billion a year into these researchers on global warming and global change, that's where the research is going to be. In East Anglia. What's that? Go ahead.
Yeah, and if you look hard enough, you're going to find a problem, you know.
Well,
they become self-fulfilling prophecy.
That's what has happened. The money has been behind this because it's a controlling mechanism.
And I couldn't believe they were talking about carbon taxes, but they made it sound like, towards the one few that I saw, they made it sound like it was taxing of the corporations more than the individual. But what did you take from that?
Each tax that that is promulgated and put on anything is always passed on to the consumer eventually. Okay? So if a corporation has to operate, they're going to pass on those costs of operation. Otherwise, they're out of business, right? So, yeah, they'll say, we need to tax those corporations. Well, they're going to tax the individual, see?
George, do you think this could make them have to address the money supply problem?
I would love for them. What's coming up in January is this World Economic Forum, okay? And we've been following it for a number of years. And at that forum, occasionally they'll discuss the money problem and capitalism. A few years ago, the head of Carlyle Company, David Rubenstein, was talking about that the Chinese form of capitalism might be the way to go. And Carlyle Group was established primarily for the Bushes. They're a big part of Carlyle Group.
They like that.
Yeah, they think state capitalism, see, that China actually has, might be the way to go, you know. That's what they're saying. But of course, we have a privately owned Federal Reserve. So it's a private system of capitalism is what we have. Crony or monopolistic capitalism is what we have in this country.
Right.
And so.
Well, do you think if your point, you know, I'm talking as if, you know, the people behind the agenda to push the climate change agenda. You know, it's like you always say, you know, they're not always in concert. Sometimes they have inner wars and inner fighting. And my thinking is that, you know, this is such a major push that do you think it could be something where it could, challenge the current money structure? That's all I'm saying.
In
the current monetary model.
Okay. What's important to tie all of this stuff together during our conversation during the first hour tonight is that the history of human rights that we discussed earlier, okay, it insinuated and implied and inferred that these were just, originally in 48, these were just words on paper, but it had no force of effect. You see what I mean? And so we just need something that more than this to make force this into reality. See what I mean? And so they started putting across the idea that maybe the UN needs to take this more seriously and put it into with force. See what I mean? And force means a UN army or an international army. See? Or it means these trade blocks now have been created, the World Trade Organization, and now we have this Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, and we have an Atlantic Agreement underway now. All of that was been kept secret from our Congress. They had to go in and just not take recorders in and leave their cell phones out and look at some of the small details of it. But it's creating monopolies for the largest corporations. Now in January, World Economic Forum will meet there in Davos, Switzerland. And they'll start discussing more of these trade deals. You remember we got onto this stuff, the public-private partnership deals, years ago. Remember that?
Oh, of course.
And that's,
yes, I do.
And that's what all of these groups are pushing, okay? What they're pushing in Paris or Davos or anywhere else are the Bilderberg group. They're all talking the same lingo, see? If they want to go in partnership with governments. And some of these corporations are bigger than governments, see? And so what I always say is that these corporate chiefs, they fly in their corporate jets and fly in and out of Washington, and the U.S. representatives fly in and out on commercial. See what I mean? So there's a big difference here. See, it's all a big money, pecking order of money and love of wealth and mammon and all that stuff, if you want to use a religious term. But so this thing in Paris is well contrived. It's a mind war system, much like Kurt Lewin of Group Dynamics. Remember Kurt Lewin that we discussed?
Oh yeah.
The Tavistock set the real high mark here on how to do this out of London. And I've sat down with that director when I was over there in 2006. Lynn Swan was the director then, but no longer. But anyway, I just checked recently, and he's left to go to another position. But anyway, I sat down and got an idea that the Tavistock is much like the Aspen Institute is here in out of Aspen, Colorado, that was founded there. See, and it's to train these corporate leaders, these academicians, and these broadcasters to think in a certain way, to think globally, to think internationally. See. And to work towards some kind of a larger governmental, you know what I mean, one world, new world order or international government. But what they're doing now is they finally realize that the nation state is a hindrance, a barrier to their operations and to putting together this larger international government. So what they're doing now is these trade groups are going to override most of the nation states' business laws. That's what they're doing, the end run around it, looks like to me right now.
So that's
what's going on that deal.
What do you think about my concept that I brought up earlier about the idea that natural rights was the philosophy that
you're right
was in the mind of our the founders of our some of the most precious documents to civil society, and this idea of human rights is overrides these horrendously important things.
You're absolutely right, Charlotte, and you're thinking you're absolutely right on. What the founding fathers were schooled in was the natural law, okay? And then that gave rise to natural rights. Well, the example of one of the natural rights as far as the amendments, the first 10 amendments to the Constitution would be the second one, the right to keep and bear arms, okay, to protect oneself. It's a natural inherent thing that we all have a natural inborn, right. It's a natural right, see, to defend yourself, to live, to continue your life, see.
And if they decide, if they decide any one of the things that was established by natural law or natural rights, thinking if they try to, all they have to do is say, we don't want this kind of speech, and therefore there goes your First Amendment, there goes free speech, no more guns, there goes your Second Amendment. I mean, it just goes out, and it's like the quick road to tyranny.
These human rights are exactly what you just said. Someday they'll say, well, your thinking is wrong about weather change, and your thinking is not positive. See what I mean? To do what's necessary for the coming, so
for the collective.
Yeah. We got somebody at the front door here. Wait just a second, okay?
Okay.
What is important is exactly what you said about the natural rights concept. Well, anyway, I'll add that then to the.
I had to look at the clock.
Okay. Oh, how much was it? How much time was it? Maybe.
Last time I looked at it, it was only you were less than 5 minutes for sure.
Okay. Well, we'll use that then as the deal. But anyway, what the founding fathers did, okay, was that they established a decoration to begin with. And also, it was based on natural law. And then arising from that were natural rights. And it was the Second Amendment is based on the right to keep and, you know, yourself safe, to keep and bear arms, to provide protection. And it begins with an individual, and then it goes, it's extended to your family and then your nation. But also, the right to keep and bear arms is to protect yourself from a repressive government. See, that's the primary Second Amendment is all about. Now, they'll go out there and they'll say, oh, the right to go hunting and stuff. Well, that's not what it's about, primarily. It's primarily to protect yourself from a very repressive government, see? And that government cannot take your arms for the goal of protecting yourself, see, in defense of yourself and family. So that's basically what we're talking about here, see?
And because of human rights, George, they would consider gun ownership, you know, that's how they would even phrase it. Gun ownership wouldn't be a human right.
No.
I bet if you were to ask, they would say owning a weapon or owning a firearm is not a human right in their book.
No, they would say that that's a threat to the government, see. They would say that.
Yeah, and see that, yeah. Herein lies the problem, folks.
That's exactly right. What they would say is that, and that's what some of this is coming from the left now, when we have all of these shootings that are taking place out here, the answer to that is that we need more control over these guns and we need more gun laws, see. But that is not the answer. A well-armed citizenry is a key to liberty, real liberty. And we're going to have to get back to that, but the government is interceding, and especially the present national government is getting in the way of actually exercising those kinds of freedoms and rights that we need to get back to, okay? And this is the conflict that exists right today with our present administration, see.
And there is a big problem that they've put United Nation people in the major metropolitan cities. According to one of our interviews, George, was it John Whitman of...
Yes, it could be. It could be, yeah. I forget.
Oh, sorry, that.
Well, John Lewis was Confessions of an Economic Hitman, but I'm not sure that that I remember the. We've interviewed over 500 people. See, you know what I mean. So over 9 years.
I'm gonna stop beating myself up over the head.
Charlotte, we've done some very, very good interviews with some fine people. I just got some feedback from a professor today that called me, and I'm not gonna say who he is. But you know these recent concepts of microaggressions and trigger statements. We talked a little bit about that.
Sure, yeah, okay. Trigger statements. Mm-hmm.
And then they call microaggressions, and there was an article written in the Atlantic magazine. And so what we have is that we have a problem in trying to get around this new level. I would say at first the university started globbing upon political correctness. Okay. But it stayed in the political arena. The groups that were using that were feminist groups and, gay groups and so forth, okay, to defend their own rights that they felt that they had, see. And that's where political correctness started getting some traction, see. They started benefiting some of these groups that would do that, see. And then later, today it's evolved into creating a cocoon around students at the universities where they're trying to protect their feelings, see. So anyone that is saying anything that's hurtful or that's feelings that, hurt someone's feelings, then is considered to be a very, very, you know, bad person, you know what I mean? And should be disciplined and should be cut loose from the university or thrown out. I mean it. And then what they're doing now is that some of the professors are being castigated by their students. And so what you have is you have these trigger statements and things like that. So what you have today is you have trigger statements and so forth, okay? And the university professors are beginning to feel threatened in their free speech endeavors, okay? And their free speech endeavors would be about how to teach their courses. They're being, infringed on. They're being, castigated by a student body, and they're networking. The students sometimes will network out in these social groups against certain professors that they have labeled and targeted as being not sympathetic to or compassionate for feelings or whatever the issue may be. See? And so you've got a tremendous change that's occurring, and not only this professor that called me today, but others I've talked to over the last few months have expressed very similar types of opinions. See, and as
that is a problem.
As a result, you've got there's a book written out, the American Mind, I believe, is the article. Is that the state of the American mind? We interviewed the editor of that book, okay? Barley, and his name is Mark Barley. And he seemed to indicate there was a collection of writings that he put together under that, the state of the American mind. And so that was a very, very important interview for us. And it put forward some of the very ideas that we're talking about, microaggressions and things like that. See?
Right.
And so it's important that we begin to talk about these things in a very free and open atmosphere, unlike is existing sometimes on the university. See? So when they had this free speech movement on the universities and they started designating certain areas for free speech areas, that was the beginning of the end as far as I saw. And I began to see that where the whole university, the whole campus, the whole community, inside or outside of on the campus or not, should be a free speech area, see. And when you start designating certain areas that free speech, this and that, then you're limiting your free speech rights right there, which would be the First Amendment. And I believe they've taken this to a whole new low or a whole new level, see, with these micro aggressions. And an example would be like, if you walked up to a person that looked like they were from India, you know, dark complexion, and they were speaking, you know, how they speak sometimes, and you made a question like, well, where are you from, in India? And they said, no, I'm an American, see? Then that would be an offense, see what I mean, to their feelings, okay?
Oh, dear.
You would be offending them because you naturally assumed that they were from India, and their extraction, their ethnic extraction, could very well be Indian, see? But you're making assumptions, see, that are not exactly correct, see what I'm saying? And so that's what...
Yeah, I never ask based on appearance, always based on accent,
right?
You know, whether or not someone...
Well, what I'm saying is that there are natural things that people assume about one another, okay? And that when you start going over and above that, and so forth, then wait just a second, okay?
There was a leak in the upstairs master bath, and it has been fixed. So yeah.
Okay. There's a house here being shown to anyone. So anyway, okay, getting back to the topic here is that we're in a dire state of affairs, see, and it's not getting any better. And the students used to be someone that you could go to and they would be standing up for real rights, you know what I mean? For natural rights. Now they've been sold as human rights, and then they're in a box, see. And then all of these other things like microaggressions and things like that seem to feed into this thing. And it hasn't been working that well. You know what I mean? And as a result, we're getting a deteriorating situation, and it's not getting any better. So anyway, that's basically. Let me call you back in about 15 minutes, okay? Let me do that. That's okay.
All right, George.
Okay.
All right. Well, sorry.
Thank you, Charlotte, very much. Okay, we'll talk to you later.
All right.
Good night. Bye bye.
Okay. Bye.
Charlotte had to leave us a few minutes early, but this hour we got into some very, very important issues and topics. But not only did we touch on this, the history of human rights, which they've really ill-defined it and tried to override the natural law and natural rights concept, but also this COP 21 in Paris is being promulgated as something that's equivalent to the 1948 Universal Declaration of Human Rights Conference. But all they're doing is they're building upon this human rights idea, which are given to us by government. And if government doesn't like what we're saying about that government, then they're going to take away everything that we hold dear and then, you know, imprison us or execute us or whatever. There are ominous signs of people that are against this global warming idea or not, you know, in concert with these international elites and shakers, that if you don't go along with this global warming idea or global change and you don't approve of this conference in Paris, then something's wrong with you, and that you're really are dangerous for the society, and that you don't really care about the society itself and the weather of the society. So these are ominous trends and ominous soundings that are occurring, and it's not something that is good and honest for us to. So Charlotte had to leave us a little early. I want to thank her for being with us this evening. And go in to COP21, and they've got a website over there in Paris, and it's in English, and start listening to some of these interviews. You're going to be very, very surprised at some of the things they say, but the conditioning, you must realize that the conditioning of these adults today what took on 30 or 40 years of conditioning or more to get to a place now that they're just all in a parrot. They're like parrots in a jungle. They're just, everyone is saying all the same things, and they're not allowing any diversion. There is a documentary that premiered in Paris at the same time that this conference is underway. And I think it's creating some interest, and we'll have that up on our website. Go into thesecrettruth.com, and you'll be able to see that conference, the alternative answer to this global change, weather change that the UN is holding there in Paris. All of this is undergoing with the background of mass killings and massacres and everything else. So it's not a good time for us to exist, but we must stand up for truth. Thank you for listening. Good night.